Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Salieri Report just a very dear friend and ally, Jason Bond-Smith, who is a highly successful entrepreneur from Australia. He's coming to us from Sydney. I'm going to let him explain. I apologize for my laryngitis, but we delayed recording this since last week and now really need to record it today, so please bear with us. Jason has just today published his book, Making Waves. I'm going to have him tell you all about his background and history. It's all part of the book, which is really a business biography. I wrote the foreword. It's excellent. I can't recommend it enough if you're interested in entrepreneurship. So, Jason, welcome to the Salieri Report.
Thank you so much, Catherine. Such an honor to be invited on what would arguably be the best podcast in the world, as far as I'm concerned. I have learned so much from you, from your guests, and I'm so happy to be here with you.
Well, it's a delight to have you, and it will be the best podcast in the world when I don't have laryngitis. Anyway, So let's start with why you wrote the book, because we're going to get into your background and what the book teaches us. But, one of my favorite quotes from you is that we used in our commentary is your complaint is your call to action. So explain to us what that means, your complaint is call to action, and explain why you wrote the book.
Sure. We'll start with the reason I wrote the book. I think it boils down to two reasons. The first is people have seen me grow a company from my lounge room to one of the biggest contaminated land consultancy companies in Australia. We now turn over $30 million a year. We have profit margins at least double, probably triple that of our competitors. And people remember me working from my lounge room, really having no idea what I was doing. And it took some time. A lot of people think success comes quickly. I can assure you it does not. I measure success in decades, not in months, not even in years. It does take a long time. So rather than tell my story over and over again, I decided to put it in writing and describe it in full detail. It's very raw. It's very vulnerable. I've been totally open and honest with everything that happened because I feel it's the challenges and the hardships that make us stronger. I've been a long-time believer in personal growth for professional success, and I think you live that through your business, not just through your life. To me, it's one and the same. I don't work, I live, and I've just found a passion that it's allowed to pay me lots of money by doing good for the environment, good for my staff, and good for me. So that's really the reason I wrote it. There is a selfish reason. I think writing down your story is very cathartic. It's healing. To be a successful memoir, and whether it's business or life, you have to have dealt with your emotional, spiritual trauma. If you haven't dealt with those issues, you can't finish your book. So it's one way to actually process it, reconcile issues that you may have had, and just to reflect. And, I was surprised, when you live your life, you just take it in your stride. And it's not until you take some time to really sit down and objectively reflect on what you've done over the past period of your life. And once you do that, it's remarkable the insights you get. Not just that you could write about for others, but to allow you to grow and go to the next level. So there was definitely a personal reason as well.
So start at the beginning and tell us the story of how you became an entrepreneur.
Yeah, a lot of people think entrepreneurs are born and not made. I think they're both. In life, it's never either or. It's always and. We always should look for a better way, and a better way is for everybody to win. So when I was a teenager, I grew up in Sydney's beaches. I used to go down to Maroubra Beach, which is a surfing beach close to where I used to live. And, you know, today people wouldn't recognise Sydney beaches, but in the 1980s, when I was at school, early 80s, the beaches were heavily polluted. We had raw sewage that would come off the major treatment plants. The one closest to Maroubra was called Malabar Sewage Treatment Plant, and it would service a third of Sydney's sewage. And it would only be screened, so it's only primary treatment. So they remove, I don't want to be too disgusting here, but all the solid materials they would remove through screens, and the rest would just float out close to shore, and then the winds would bring it onto the beaches. And I never forget the day I was walking down to the beach, and it was one of those perfect days. You know, it was early morning, the sun was rising, the winds were offshore, so it means the waves were at its peak. The swell was good, about 3 or 4 foot. The sand had perfect banks. It was just one of those ideal days. And you start paddling out, and as soon as you get out there, you could start smelling raw effluent. And it was so bad. There were condoms, tampons, feces. It was disgusting. It was so vile. So here I am, a 16-year-old kid, and I'm just going, oh, my goodness. Now, because the surf's so good, what do you do as a teenager? You continue to surf. But when I got home, I spent about half an hour, 40 minutes in the shower, and my mother wasn't too happy with me wasting all the hot water and spending so much time. And I said to her, she said to me, sorry, why are you in the shower so long? So I described what I'd just been through. And she looked at me and said, well, you're just going to have to go and fix it. And I looked at her and gone, how am I ever going to do that? She said, I don't know how you're going to do it. You're just going to do it. And it's funny how those little comments sit with you. So I spent literally the next 6 years of my life working out ways to solve Sydney's beach pollution. Now, I'm not taking credit for it. I was just one small cog in the wheel. But I went on some incredible adventures, including going to a university specifically on water pollution, which I graduated with high distinction from because I was so interested in the topic. And then I purposely went and worked for New South Wales Health Department because back then there was no EPA. The health department did most of the environmental work, and there was a State Pollution Control Commission that just did licensing issues for facilities. And they ran the beach pollution issue, which was growing and growing in importance. It got so big that they started having public meetings and parliament select committees. So I was lucky enough to be invited into the beach sampling program, and I basically was the main person who went and collected the samples from the beaches along Sydney, sent them to our labs, and collated the results and wrote up the reports. Now, obviously, everything was confidential, but I was so motivated to fix this problem, I had to get the message out. So at these meetings, I would sneak in, I'd wear like hoods on my head, you know, track, and go in disguise outside of my area, so over the other side of the harbour, and I'd ask really difficult questions to the EPA, the health department, the water board, and those people on the committees. And it got to a stage where I just get standing ovations for the questions I'd ask because I was cheating, right? I knew the answers to the questions because I was collating the report. And through that process, a friend of a friend asked me to get involved a bit more politically. And there was a radio announcer, a guy called Mike Petrie on Today FM, and he did the surf report every morning. And through about 4 or 5 people, so I wouldn't get caught, I would release the results to him, and he'd announce it on Sydney radio. Well, didn't that cause a stir? And I never got caught, right? Because I can never trace it back to me. But the long and the short of it was, we wanted to pump the sewage back over the Blue Mountains and use it as compost, you know, for fertility of soils. Australia have very poor soils, but we didn't win that one. But they did build better tertiary treatment on our sewage treatment plants and then put ocean outfalls in to disperse the sewage further out to sea. So when you come to Sydney now, you will see whales during whale season. You'll see pristine water. It really is some of the cleanest city beaches.
Oh, it's just so beautiful. The beaches are incredible and the water is so beautiful. And it makes Sydney such a beautiful city, one of the most beautiful in the world.
Yeah, I'm totally biased, but I have to agree with you. So that didn't start my entrepreneurship. Obviously, it was using some skills as an entrepreneur on solving problems and creating value. And if there's two things I want to leave the audience with, you really need to be able to solve a problem and create massive value if you want to be successful. So in the health department, I was just not happy working there. Everything just moved too slow. And I was a go-get-em sort of guy. I was about to leave and my supervisor said, well, how about if we fund your master's degree and you can stay for a bit longer? So I thought, okay, get paid to do another science degree. That'd be cool. So I went to university part-time, and this is at a time where Australia's last recession 25 years ago, and we had mortgage rates of 17%, and I had a property then. And oh, it was hard. I was working two jobs and going to university. But while I was at university, I went up to my supervisor and said, I'm just not really enjoying these classes. I'm just not learning as much as I'd like to. I enjoy experience. I don't really like reading. I actually can't read very well. And I need to have my hands in amongst what we're doing, not just sitting in a lecture and taking notes and doing exams. So he offered me an opportunity to do half the course via a project, as long as I found a decent project that suited the university. And when I was at the health department, a pediatrician who was newly arrived from the US came in and said, what are you guys doing about childhood lead poisoning? We all looked at each other and said, what do you mean? Like, we get two or three cases a year. What's the problem? And what he explained, now this is back in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. Australia hadn't recognised the effect of low blood leads. So very low blood lead levels now cause neurological problems and brain damage and behavioural problems and a whole host of other issues. And the Australian health departments hadn't caught up with that data. So our blood lead levels were only when a child got symptomatic. Now, if a child has symptoms of lead poisoning, they're halfway to death. That's how far behind our health department was.
Right.
So I went, wow, there's an opportunity. So I remember there was a study done in Balmain where we had all these lead poisoned dogs. Dogs were literally seizing and dying in an area of Balmain, so, which was only about 20 minutes from our office. So I pulled out the files, had a look, and went, wow, this would be a great environmental study. I'll go around, collect some environmental samples, some soil, some dust, some paint, some air, and work out what the levels of contamination are for lead. Now, the health department, my boss has said, that's great, but we want you to add blood. And I went, what? I'm an environmental guy. I don't know how to take blood samples. So I went to the university, and they said, that would be fantastic. So I went, how do I do blood leads? I knew the health department didn't have the skills in-house to understand the problem, so I went externally to try and find someone who really understood low blooded levels, and I found a trace element analyst, a guy called Graham Waller, an amazing man, unbelievable man. And he taught me everything he knew about how to take biological samples for lead. So we organised it all, and I door-knocked an area in Balmain of about 800 houses and identified 50 children within the target range of 9 months to 48 months. And I was kind of presented with an issue of how do I convince a parent who's got an potential invisible health issue in their child's blood to offer their baby's arm to have a needle stuck in its vein? So it was quite a good sales effort. Now, I was very lucky that I convinced 47 parents of the 47 of the 50 children identified in the area, I convinced their parents to offer their arm, their child's arm, for a venipuncture blood test, which apparently is still a record for a participation rate for a survey. The interesting thing was half the kids had blood levels over the World Health Organization or the CDC's level of concern. And that was a massive finding. I can't tell you the impact that had on the politics, on the health department, on the parents, on the community. It was quite staggering. I knew I had a hot potato with my thesis, so I carefully worked out ways that were going to protect me in case it got leaked, which was very fortunate because my university professor leaked the report to the media and it made national press. It was on the 7:30 report on ABC, which is a national free-to-air channel here in Australia. Well, I'm not going to go into what happened, but there was massive ramifications for me and my ability to maintain my job at the health department. Now, I didn't get that. They blamed me for leaking it. It wasn't me. The university refused to admit that that it was them. They had this kind of legal and privilege they stand behind. And I don't want to go through the stories of what happened next, but it was pretty horrifying. I stayed on for a little bit longer. I really wanted to focus on the source of the lead because everyone in Australia wanted to blame lead petrol. We still had lead petrol back in the early 90s. I knew it wasn't lead petrol, and I worked on behind the scenes working on proving why lead paint was the biggest issue. And I have to thank my American colleagues back then who gave me so much support and evidence, which I eventually released at a conference in Newcastle, an international lead conference. And I got even more trouble. It was very serious. I got,
you know, I have to say one of the things that creates thousands, if not millions, of entrepreneurs is having these kinds of experience working with academia and government.
Well, I think it toughens you up. I can assure you of that. It makes you very resilient. And if you can get through it, then you come out so much stronger and wiser, and you can use that in your
future career.
Well, but
I'm serious. I just want to interrupt for a second. It's one of the reasons when you need to implement a lot of change fast, it's important to understand that entrepreneurs are free to do that in a way government and academia is not free. And I think it's one of the reasons entrepreneurship is so important right now.
Oh, more than ever. You know, I think it's Franklin Sanders who says any dependency on the government comes with a sock to the jaw. And he's half right because now it comes with a jab to the arm. I don't know if you know about vaccination rules in Australia now, but any government support, whether it be child support for a parent or a pension for the elderly, you are not entitled to any government money as of the 1st of January this year without having full vaccination. So more than ever, we need to be independent, and we'll right. talk about how we're going to achieve that over the coming minutes. So lo and behold, I wasn't meant to stay in the health department for much longer. They could not sack me. I was totally cleared of everything. However, I knew my time had come, and lead had become a bit of an issue. So I was getting lots of phone calls to do some assessments. So I started my consultancy company. I was 28 years of age, and I started JBS Environmental from my lounge room. And the story gets a little bit more interesting because one of the traits of being a great entrepreneur is following your intuition and being able to have the intestinal fortitude to make the big decisions when you really know it's right. It may not make logical sense, and I'm going to give you an example of what happened to me, but you just know inside your soul that you needed to do it. So here I am. I actually enrolled in a PhD. And I started collecting on lead because I wanted more and more evidence to show what was going on. And I had a great supervisor, Chris Winder, Professor Chris Winder. And he allowed me to work with his consultancy company to collect more data. So this win-win scenario I always look for, you know, get paid twice for doing the same job so I can collect my data and get some money to pay for my lifestyle and my expenses. And I was about halfway through the PhD and I just realized there had to be a better way to test the environment. And I'd been at a conference in the US a couple of years prior and they had these amazing portable X-ray fluorescent spectrum analyzers. Now, what's that in English? It's like a portable hairdryer that you could point to a film of paint or the soil or dust, and it would give you a full element analysis. So it'd give you how much lead, zinc, copper, arsenic, kind of half the periodic table. It was just fantastic. And no one believes that you could have a handheld lab, that you could actually have a lab in your hand. But I did, because I saw the technology, and more importantly, I had dogs dying, I had poisoned kids, I had contaminated areas that I needed to know where it was coming from. It was imperative. I couldn't do my job because I was waiting 3 to 7 days even to get the lab results. By then, it could be too late, and I just needed to get the results. So I had to buy this technology. Now, the problem was our exchange rate was pretty low, kind of like it is today, and it cost $70,000. Now, that's a massive investment on a piece of technology. Now, my unit had about, my apartment had about $70,000 worth of equity in it. So I thought, okay, I'll sell my property and buy the instrument. Now, you can imagine my parents and my friends were going, "You're crazy. What are you buying a piece of technology that has no proven track record? No one's ever bought one outside of America. And you're going to sell your property. Like, you're crazy. Don't do it. Don't do it." But I had to. I just had to. And maybe today I wouldn't be. I'd find another way to raise the money. But back then, it was my only option. So I sold the property and I bought the technology. Now, the interesting story about that technology, which kind of became a hobby, it took me years to convince the mining industry. But before we get to that, I want to tell another little story. I spent years working mainly in residential and small commercial doing consultancy work, and I couldn't make ends meet. I really couldn't make ends meet. The clients wanted much more than what they could afford to pay for, and I was working around the clock, really big hours. You know, we're talking 14, 16 hours a day just to keep, you know, the bills paid and things working. I just couldn't break out of it. I knew there had to be a better way. And luckily for me, through an experience which I won't talk about today because we'll be here forever if we tell my whole story, I got a job in a mining community out of Broken Hill, which is Australia's longest living mine. It's a lead, zinc, silver mine, and it really was the industrialisation of Australia, and the union movement was all born in Broken Hill. Now, the new owner who purchased it was very concerned about the lead liabilities. So he heard about me and what I've done. So he invited me in and said, "Write a full risk management strategy for us purchasing this mine." And it was just a briefing paper. I didn't think we'd ever win the job because everyone on the street said another mining company was about to buy it. And then out of the blue, because I'd let it go, he rings up and says, "Right, you know that briefing paper you wrote?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You got 3 months to do it." I went, "What?
Oh, my God."
It's just like, I've got 3 staff. I've got a small little office, struggling to make ends meet, and we're giving this massive, massive project. Now, of course, you say yes. You say yes and go, "Right, hang up, and how the hell am I going to do this?" So we did. You know, I spent 3 months full-time in Broken Hill. I had a team of, started with 20 young, mainly delinquent guys out of South Australia. And, oh, it's a massive story in itself. But the good news is that project ended up, it was a $400,000 brief that came out to $1.2 million by the time we left, because when a client sees you're doing a good job and you're actually looking at their outcomes, so your mindset is the outcome of the client. What does the client try to achieve? So if you're in alignment and totally coherent with their outcomes, they just give you more and more work. That project went to $1.2 million in a three-month time frame, and we made over $400,000 profit. It was a company maker and proved to me that I could do the big commercial jobs. And more importantly, it gave exposure to the technology, this portable XRF, the hairdryer. And it was then and there that I realized that working for the property industry in contaminated land and doing residential lead assessments really wasn't my calling. It was really to go to mining and help them reduce their impact, mainly in exploration, but also in the mining itself. They had the same problem I did when I was testing backyards. They weren't getting the results. So they'd be out in the middle of the bush. I mean, right in the outback, middle of nowhere, with these big drill rigs taking thousands of samples and then sending them by courier to the lab and waiting for the results to come back. Now, the project management costs in those delays are in the millions. It's massive. And to be able to do those assays, even if they weren't what they call JORC compliant, which is a standard procedure to provide the market, the stock exchange, with your reserves, it was still a great screening tool, and you can make all your project management decisions in the field. So we had an amazing impact on that industry, and I can say now that portable hairdryer that I took the risk to sell my unit and bring to Australia is now one of the most common analytical tools on every exploration and mine site in the world. So it was a magnificent win for the kids, for lead poisoning, for the mining industry, and for my back pocket, because with no IP and no product, just a great company with goodwill and a good client list and fantastic staff, I sold that for several million dollars to a competitor just before the collapse in 2008. So, which was just fluke. I'm not that smart.
But I think the point that really comes out in the both in your story and the book is that first you try and sincerely figure out how to solve an important problem, and then you figure out how to make money on it. You know, it'd be great if you could do it both at the same time, but you've got to stay entirely focused on solving that problem.
You have to stay focused on the end result of your client. You must be outcome focused. If you're not outcome focused on behalf of your client, then there's no need for you because they can do it themselves.
Right.
Yeah, problem solving is really where you're at for a business. So the book itself kind of goes through, and maybe I can do it a different way rather than just going through the book. A lot of people ask me, what's their fundamental purpose? They all feel they're here for a reason. They all want to leave. Maybe they're working for a company that's doing harm, and they have a passion and they really want to find how to manifest it. So what I'd recommend to those people is you've got to find something you're good at. If you're not good at it, then you won't be able to pull it off. And then you have to find something that really upsets you. I mean, really, really, I'm going to swear, but I'll stop swearing because we have a very polite audience and I have a tendency to speak too much like an Australian. But it really upsets you. It's that pebble in your shoe that will not go away. It just hurts every time you walk. It just drives you crazy. Like the beach pollution did for me, like the assault of lead on the kids in Sydney where people wouldn't take it seriously. It just really upset me. The impact miners were making on the planet when they could have had a technology to minimize the amount of drilling and digging they were doing. What's the impact that's right. happening in your life that just totally pisses you off? And it's got to be strong. It's got to be strong. And the reason it's got to be strong is there's going to be many times when you start your company or your business that you just don't want to get out of bed. It's just one of those days and it's been really tough. You're exhausted. Whatever has happened in your personal life, you have to have something that annoys you to such an extent that you have to get up. and just power through those hard times. And they're going to happen.
And the issue, I get back to your expression, your complaint is your call to action. So, and one of the things I always say is, you know, don't ask how you can fix the problem. Ask how you can make money fixing the problem, because then you can fix the problem.
Correct. You know, your beautiful saying, which I have stolen, we'll talk about it in a minute, is no transactions, no change. And
right.
That is so important. That is so important. But before we get there.
And so many of the people who want change think that transactions are bad. It's crazy.
Oh, it's totally crazy. I want to get into more detail in a minute about that. But I want to talk about play and getting in touch with the inner child.
Okay.
A lot of people think play is frivolous. It's something you do as a kid. They really don't understand how play is essential. It really helps your creative problem-solving skills. It balances out your stress. It increases your resilience. And, you know, the most important part of play is imagination. And we can talk about your invention room or things of that nature during this conversation if you like. But play is really, really important. And you'll find when you go back to that kind of time when you're 8, 7, 8, 9, there is something you did back then that can relate to what you're doing now that will give you that fun, that fulfillment that you're looking for. It may be totally unrelated. For me, it was water and playing in the pool and pretending to be Marine Boy, and that led me to beach pollution and the water things in my life, and it was the business stuff that brought me back onto the land with mining and so forth. But play is really essential. And I just want people to really reflect on that. It's not all business. It's got to be fun. It's got to be fun. And, you know, I personally went back to when I was 8, worked out what I'd love to do, and I've implemented that in my life now. I bought a table tennis table to play ping pong. I put a pinball machine in the office so the staff can play pinball. You know, I go to the beach as much as I can, like I used to when I was a kid. I'm really putting that into my life because it just helps my stress levels, it helps my enjoyment, and just makes life so much more fun. So I want to stress that. The other thing you need to look at when you're trying to find out maybe your fundamental purpose is your personal history. Your story is your life. It's a, you know, you've got a life book there. You need to go back through your life and see what worked, what didn't work, what excited you, what you're good at, and really go through your personal history. Now, once you've done those three things, then you can work out how to monetize it. And the great thing about today, there's more opportunity to monetize an idea or a business than ever before. Now, there's a few more obstacles and regulation and government interference and big business trying to take over the world, but it gives us more opportunity and the time is right for entrepreneurship. And if we don't do it, when we talk about the next phase of the interview with the technology changes that's coming, the tsunami as I call it, we really have no choice.
Let's stop here and let's take a dive into what I call global 2.0 to 3.0. So moving from an industrial economy to a networked economy, you spent a lot of time looking at technological change. And I think you're one of the people I know who really appreciates how dramatic the next 5 to 10 years is going to be. So maybe if we could just take a few minutes and you talk about your impressions of what is happening in technology and what you think it's going to do to the economy and why we're going to need an incredible amount of entrepreneurship to deal with it.
Wow, that's a big subject. Where do we start? Let's start with why people can't see it. This is one of the biggest things that I find with people is human beings are designed to think linearly. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. So it's small increments improving all the time. What they don't understand is technology is based on doubling, or what they call exponential. And that's something I'm going to give a couple of examples so people can really get it, because it's a mindset that people really struggle with. So I want to, let's look at a pond, and you put one lily in that pond on day one. So on day two, there's two lily pads. And the process continues until the 20th day. On the 20th day, the pond is now saturated. It's full with lily pads. Now, what day was it when it was half full? It was the 19th day. So you can see with exponential growth, it's the last step that has half of the growth. So it's not 10% at a time. It's like a doubling all the time. So the last step is half the growth. Some more examples if that wasn't enough. But the concept they use is called Moore's Law. It's computer. It's basically brought through computers and what they call a technology S-curve. So it relates back to transistors. But one of the ways that kind of I got the computing power is that those old enough to remember, we had the old relay kind of circuit boards. They weren't even circuit boards, they were relays. And you could see them increasing like an S-curve, and then it tapers off. So everyone says, well, exponential tapers off and it doesn't happen anymore. But what they don't understand is that the vacuum tube came halfway through the relay and it increased it anymore. And then the transistors came and increased computing power even more. And now we're dealing with integrated circuits. So even though a particular technology may become redundant after its growth stage, because it does taper off, there's a new technology that allows it to grow even more. So that's where it's coming from. It's the computer power that's really pushing a lot of these technologies. Now, I don't know how many technologies you want to go through, Catherine, but let's just choose a couple because we literally could be here for 2 days.
All day and all night, right?
Yeah, so let's pick a couple. Let's pick artificial intelligence. And while I call the phenomenon a tsunami, like this massive wave that's coming, it has been a slow trickle behind the scenes. It's the boiling frog that we haven't realized that when I go to the gas station or petrol station, as we call it in Australia, I can't get any fuel until a machine gives me permission. I can't go to the grocery store until a machine lets me purchase. And I can't even get any money until I go to a hole in the wall where a machine allows me to access my funds. So we think we're not influenced overly by artificial intelligence and computers and technology, but we are. We are totally controlled by it without even realizing it. Now, I tell people, you know, Mr. Global is reading your mind and he has your fingers in your brain. This is how subtle it's been and how invasive. So artificial intelligence is kind of taking us from this historical kind of industrial evolution 2.0 scenario where we have a service economy which is listening to us, it's looking at us, it's reading us, it's even writing. You wouldn't believe it. There's a company called Narrative Science that writes editorials for Forbes magazines and other major publications. So you have AI that's writing editorials. And this is all integrated in what they call integrated knowledge. So it's quite incredible what's coming. And you couple that with sensors. People don't realize how many sensors they've just got in their mobile phone. Now, you've got, you know, 20 different sensors in their mobile phone. You add all the sensors in your house, which is even getting worse. We'll talk about that a bit later maybe, that you're being surveilled nonstop. What else have we done recently? Well, we've invented drones. People think drones are toys. There's nothing further from the truth. These are military weapons. They have capabilities and sensors, not just cameras, but they can sense infrared, they can sense humidity, they can do lots of different testing. And soon, maybe as early as this year, governments around the world are going to allow commercial use of these drones. We're going to see
hundreds of thousands. Let me just mention, the drones in combination with microsatellites are going to massively increase the internet access, not just through cable, but through the air. And with the rollout of smartphones, once you have everybody on the planet accessible through the internet, then you're talking about a whole bunch of different models that can flip. And the drones are going to make an incredible contribution to that.
Yeah, it's like another layer. You talk about in your space presentations, the orbital satellites. Well, now there's another layer. It's like the net is getting tighter and tighter around the Earth. And right. They're going to know anything, anytime, anywhere. And these right. sensors and drones don't turn off. They'll use solar-powered energy to fly around nonstop and never turn off. It's incredible. And this is happening now. Not tomorrow.
Right.
It's happening now.
Right. Well, the U.S. has not approved the commercial yet, but it's expected this year.
It is expected this year. An AI international treaty is being negotiated this year. They're rolling it out very, very quickly. The speed of which is very interesting to me on why it's so, so important to be quick. But if you want to study things like this, go to Qualcomm and see what they're doing with sensors. There is so much stuff going on, and I don't want to spend too much time because it gets a little bit frightening and concerning. however, I'm going to get over that in a minute because I've reconciled that with myself, and it doesn't mean everyone can do that. What's another one we'll do quickly? 3D printing. Why haven't we seen 3D printing take off as quickly as everyone said? Of course, it's slow, but within the next few years, it'll be 100, maybe even 1,000 times faster. So we really will take the factory and put it in our linen cupboard. It'll be that right. dramatic in the next decade or so.
Right. The and other I think one another I want wild to talk- card is energy technology.
Exactly.
If you look at both renewables and breakthrough energy, the possibilities mm-hmm. are astonishing within a relatively short period of time.
Yeah, I was just about to mention energy. The biggest kind of shock to me was the improvement in material science. So material science are now doing their own genome project. So they're taking the periodic table, the 172 elements, they're putting it into an AI program, and they are combining it the million different ways they can and popping out little samples and working out ways they can use things. So when it comes to energy, the photovoltaic cells that we've used in solar power are now going to be phased out with a new material. It's called perovskite, P-E-R-O-V-S-K-I-T-E. It's a new material that they're going to use for solar cells that are 100 even 1,000 times cheaper than the existing cells. So with that technology that everyone says is not ready yet, but remember, we double our ability to improve technology. It's not small increments, it's a doubling. So in 15 years, it's predicted that humanity can use solar power for all its needs. And that's a massive statement, and that shocked me when I learned that. Now, it doesn't mean that we'll use solar power for everything, because it all depends on adoption and depends what Mr. Global wants to do with his, BP and Shell shares. oil and gas own the infrastructure, so it may take a little bit longer. But when I'm seeing the oil price, Catherine, and you're the finance wizard, not me, I'm wondering, is all this production all about producing as much oil as they can while they can sell it, because they know in the next 10 or 20 years there's no market?
Right.
I just think, is that a reason? Now, you've talked about cold fusion. We learned about that at the New Paradigm Conference that we
attended. The Germans have brought up the first fusion plant, and Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman have both said they had it. In fact, we saw last week Dennis Gartman come out and talk about it, which was pretty astonishing. That you've got somebody who's known in the commodities markets for his market calls, basically saying, okay, the change is coming.
Yeah, so what does that do for your investments, like for commodities? And Australia is a big commodity producer, and with prices so low, we're having our blue chip stocks like BHP and Rio Tinto talking about cutting, even ending their dividends. Now, that'll have a horrific effect on their share price. And I know a lot of pension funds and what we call superannuation have those shares because they're blue chip and they always issue dividends. So it has this has a big impact over coming years for lots of disruption.
One of the things I said in the commentary for our discussion today was that new technology can be very deflationary. So I use Skype as an example, and I know you're coming in from Sydney on Skype. You know, Skype in 2013 had $2 billion of revenue, but that was $37 billion of losses to telcos. So they were, you know, increase in productivity says I can now do for $2 billion what it used to cost me $37 billion to do. So that's unleashing lots of productivity. At the same time, that's a that's $35 billion shrink on the GDP. So it can be very deflationary. And there's one thing I wanted to bring up. That deflation has been going on for a long time. So let's use your example of the pond and the lily pad doubling up. While that has been going on, we have been doing both huge increases in debt and huge amounts of monetary inflation that has covered up the deflationary effects of technology. And now the debt bubble, or building a debt bubble, and the quantitative easing is over, just as the lily pad is about to go for 50% in one day. And so all the market, you know, in a market economy, we would have been adapting all along. And it's not to say that we haven't been adapting. But if you look at the general population, their adaptation has really been misaligned as a result of the debt bubble and the monetary bubble and the different bubble tricks. And they haven't felt the real bite of technology that they would otherwise. And they're going to feel it now just as it's really, you know, going straight up the S curve.
Yeah, and it's going to hurt a lot more because they weren't expected coming, and it has the potential to wipe them out. So it's significant. Right. Yeah.
So let's go back to entrepreneurship, because I've spent a long time in America talking about why I'm so opposed to the not-for-profit model, because I believe it is essential that all change be economically viable. And the only way you're going to make it economically viable is to find that point in the marketplace where it is economically viable. And so there needs to be a huge amount of what's done that's for profit. And we have a real culture that's grown up in the United States that somehow making money is bad. And what they don't understand is making money is not bad. It's making money in a way that is harmful is bad. Making money in a way that solves problems and add value. The win-win model is fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's the most efficient model going. And I think one of the reasons I love Making Waves is you make that very clear. The enormous efficiency for all the humans involved in the whole ecosystem of having a win-win model. And maybe if you could talk a minute about how that relates to responding to this acceleration and change.
Sure. It's so important what you just said. The millennials I meet who are coming through, the 20-year-olds, for some reason, they just want to start non-for-profits. They are so insulted by the way the markets have been corrupted that they refuse to believe that we've never had a free market. It's always been corrupted since they've been alive. And we need to teach them that when you look at the essence of a market, it is the most productive thing we can do. And the best way I can explain this, and this is for the younger people, is go to your local farmer's market. That's a market. That's the market, right? That's the same as any market, except it sells produce. So you'll go to your local suppliers of fruit and vegetables and meat and seafood. Some stores will have clothes. And they have worked at home or in their gardens and bringing that produce to a centralized position where they get to trade. 9 times out of 10, they're going to trade for fiat currency, for money. They may barter, they may swap things, but that's the essence of a market. Now, if you've ever been to a farmer's market, how do you feel? You feel great. Everyone's happy. Everyone's enjoying life. They're seeing this fantastic produce. They're exchanging things of value. Everyone's being treated fairly. That's a free market. And that's what I want people to think about when they think of a market economy, is a farmer's market. Don't think of Wall Street or the stock exchange. Think of a farmer's market. That's where I want you to start. Okay, so let's get into some solutions for everyone who's now freaking out that, you know, there is potential for 50% of people to lose their jobs. That is a real possibility. Now, Humans are terrific at adapting and being creative, and it may not be as significant impact as that, but there are certain things we can do. And I'm just going to give some examples, kind of some fun examples that, you know, relate to me, and hopefully they relate to you. So I enjoy coffee. So when I go to America, I can never find a good cup of coffee because you all drink filtered coffee by the jug. And I'm thinking, I just need a good what we call espresso. And it's very, very hard to find. It's becoming a little bit more common. So when we're facing a wave, we've got two options. And I'm going to come back to the coffee example in a minute. So you can run at the front of the wave. So you can paddle out, get onto the wave, ride the lip where the power is, and you can motor home and take advantage of the situation. The second option you have is after the decimation has come through and wiped everyone out, there is an opportunity to help clean up and maybe retrain people. So getting back to coffee, coffee is made by a barista. Now, it's a very mechanical process where it comes down to the grinding, the fineness of the coffee, and actually the humidity of the room. The froth is determined by the temperature of the milk before it starts. It's got to be cold, and then the temperature of the steam to make the frothy milk when you're making a cappuccino or flat white. That is all automated. Now, if I was interested in robotics, I would definitely be looking at setting up an automated barista coffee outlet across America, because you could automate that. You could make it very, very simple. Now, everyone's going to say to me, well, you're going to miss the barista's smile and the chat you have. Well, unfortunately, computers are getting very, very good at understanding facial recognition, expressions, the materials that are coming out that are even going to look like humans. And because they understand and recognize features, as you walk up to the counter, they're going to know your name, what coffee you like. If you don't feel like coffee today, what kind of hot chocolate you like, they're going to know more about it than any human could because of their memory capabilities. So if I was to front run a business opportunity in America today, I'd be looking at automated baristas. I think it'd be hugely successful. So the second problem, now we've lost all our hospitality industry because, you know, most of it can be automated. We've got Japanese opening up a hotel that's totally run by robotics. Now, I don't want to go to a hotel that's run by robots, but it's coming and we're not going to stop it. So what are people going to do about the hospitality industry? Now, I don't have a solution for that, but these are skills that people have, and I'm sure they can be retrained into other industries that needs that type of worker. I can give you a different example. I met a young lady, who was so concerned about students not being able to get a job while they're studying and when they're at university, so school and college. So she made a company called Student Made, which is a cleaning house chore company that only employs students. And with technology today, you've got, you know, all your platforms, whether it be Airbnb, Uber, and the other ones you all know about. She's been able to run a very successful company using a labor force that is in abundance, and setting up work for all them at a cheaper rate than they can normally do through
right, and they're very intelligent. They're very good at what they do.
Well, and the other thing is they get the problem with the millennials, they get a reward for participating today. Now, unfortunately, the world doesn't work like that. And you're going to win and you're going to lose. And the world of business and life you're going to get knocked down and you have to learn to get up again. So I'm sure there's something about cleaning a toilet that really brings life back to these students who may have come from quite a privileged background. And I think that's a really good life skill, just to level the playing field and let them understand what a good performance is and a bad performance is and how you get tips and so forth. So I think there's a lot of life lessons in teaching students how to do that.
One of the things, Jason, I wanted to bring up, you and I were emailing the other day because somebody sent me a wonderful ally sent me a form saying that a business associate of theirs wanted me to jump onto a form that companies signed to commit to all sorts of higher-minded principles. And I wrote back and I said, never. And it's very much in line with my opposition to something called B Corp. There are all sorts of models that you, where an owner commits to undertaking all sorts of, you know, complex legal and environmental obligations. And the reality is what it does is it makes the world safer for the bad guys. It makes life much more complicated and dangerous for the good guys. I was wondering, when we talk about the model, the win-win model, if you could just talk a little bit about sort of those hybrid models.
Yeah, there's quite a movement. It's called conscious capitalism that's kind of sweeping the world. And it has two issues. One is the not-for-profit issue, where we talked about we need transactions to make change. And the second problem is loading up all these new businesses with reams and reams and reams and hours and hours and hours of compliance paperwork. Now, there's nothing worse than being bogged down in a system that creates no value for your customers, no value for your clients, and no value for your staff. It's just complete, utter waste of time. And it's a purpose strategy to block young up-and-coming businesses from competing against the bigger boys. So ignore them, don't participate, and focus on your business. Focus on what's good for you, what's good for your clients, and what's good for your staff. They're the three things you've got to focus on.
Right, and you're going to have enough problem competing up against the bad guys. You know, I had to compete with bad guys who could get the Department of Justice to spend $45 million to shut me down. You know, so the last thing, one of the reasons I was fine is, you know, I had kept my organizational structure very clean, very simple. Our compliance was impeccable. If I had had a B Corp, I'd be dead today. So it's really important to understand you live in a world of economic warfare and to, you know, to build an operation which can be successful inside of it. Well, yeah, I wanted
to keep things,
You're down in Australia, and the Australian, I think of the Australian people as very entrepreneurial, but clearly with commodities down and China growth slowing, you know, this kind of transition is going on in Australia. Maybe if you could speak a little bit about how the Australian economy is making the switch.
Yeah, a great question. Australia is genuinely the lucky country, and I can say that with evidence. We have not had a recession for 25 years. We sailed through the Asian economic crisis. We sailed through the GFC. The economy has pretty much grown around 2 to 4%. It's now a little bit lower, about 2.5% at the moment. Our inflation rates are around 1.7. Our cash rate, so the Reserve Bank, it's the equivalent of the Federal Reserve, is 2%. The average mortgage would be around 4-4.5%. You would think that with commodities really going to the toilet, that we would be struggling. But I can tell you that every restaurant's packed. You struggle to make a haircut appointment. Things are really moving, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne. And guess what they are? They're the 3.0 cities.
Right.
I was speaking to my brother-in-law the other day, and he's a big property developer working for major listed companies. And I said, what's the number one floor space? Who takes more floor space in the commercial buildings in Sydney now than anyone else. It's always been the banks, right? It's always been the banks. Now it's tech companies.
Right.
So you can see that Australia is not just dependent on mining. It makes about 7-8% of GDP. Agriculture is near that, probably a little bit less, 5-6%. But we're a country that's really focused on its service sector, and we're really focused on servicing Asia as the economic powerhouse of the future. So we have transitioned pretty well. Some of the companies that you might know, Atlassian just listed on the US Stock Exchange. We've had some other great companies. Cochlear is a technology company. We're very big in tourism, education, and aged care, and that makes up a big portion of our service sector. But we're not as struggling as much as everyone would think so. And it's mainly due to the management of exchange rate.
Go ahead.
It's really what buffers us, the exchange rate. When everything gets a little bit tough, our exchange rate goes right down. We're down to, 70 cents, I think, today, 71 cents. And that gives us the buffer to our exporters and obviously makes the imports more expensive and the overseas travel a lot more expensive, but it does help the local producers. And I think that's one of the most effective strategies that we've used to keep the economy strong.
Right. Well, I will have to tell you this. You know, I used to run a nightclub in Hong Kong many years ago. And what was fascinating was every ethnic group was always fighting with another. So the Chinese and the British were always fighting. The Russians and the Americans were fighting. But what every ethnic did was nobody fought with Australia. Everybody loved the Australians. the Australians were always the guys who brokered the solution. It was amazing. It was kind of funny.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can tell who's really loved when everybody gets drunk. They were the guys who always stopped the fights. They didn't start the fights unless one Australian was fighting with another. Anyway, so I before we go, I also want to talk. You're one of the guys who changed my life because you got me to go to the Australian Outback. And it was the first time in my life that I've ever been in a place where outer space was an intimate part of day-to-day life. You know, you really felt connected to the planets, the stars. You really, part of it is this, in the southern sky, you can see everything. And it's so beautiful. You know, but the other is the creation stories of the Aborigines really bring you close to, you know, your connection to sort of what's going on out there. And the third thing is, of course, when I saw the rock formations, particularly Attila in the outback, and you realize, oh my God, you know, that's not a rock formation. That's a landing pad. And, you know, and in your mind, you see the kind of civilization that would need a landing pad that looked like that. And you realized, okay, now everything makes sense. So maybe if you could just touch, because I think everybody should definitely take a trip to Australia, but maybe if you could talk a little bit about the outback and why it will change why it will remove your disassociation from space.
Yeah, before we get to the space, I just want to bring it back to life. We spent a lot of time talking about technology during this process, but technology is a construct. It's something we've invented. Life existed before technology. It's part of our world. We are not part of it. And that makes us so much stronger and so much wiser than technology will ever be. So don't let the fear of all this change, all this, you know, mad rush to adopt technology, which is disconnecting us from who we are. Everyone's relationship with the divine is their own journey. But there is something bigger that we need to understand, that we need to appreciate, and we need to explore. And I've been fortunate enough to be standing in the middle of Stonehenge in the UK, been the pyramids in Egypt and other sacred sites around the world. But there is something just incredible that standing at Uluru or Agila, which is this neighbouring rock, and there's not a soul to be seen, and you look up to the sky at night, and it's littered with stars. I mean, you know why they call it the Milky Way when you go to Australia. It's like a big condensed milk spill. The density of the stars is so great, and it feels like you could touch them. They feel close. And it's like, it's just like next door. It has this incredible feeling of, wow, how big, how beautiful is this universe, and how we are connected with them. It has an effect on most people that changes their life, just like Catherine alluded to. It is an experience that everyone should have. You can probably get it in South Africa and maybe down in southern parts of Chile. But in the Australian outback, it's something about being on the oldest continent in the world with the oldest original people. Then there's pretty good evidence that the Aboriginals were the first race, not the Negroes. I know that's controversial, but there's some pretty good science behind that. And these Aboriginals look so primitive to us because we're technology advanced. But when you understand their ability to travel through dimensions, their ability to navigate with the stars, their ability to find water, find food, and to live so harmoniously with life and nature, it puts us to shame. It really does. And we've lost that connection. And a great way to step back into your power, into the power of your beingness, is to stand in the middle of the desert in Central Australia amongst the most magnificent natural landforms, being Uluru, Attila, and the Olgas, staring at the sky while having a three-course dinner, having some great guides explain the creation stories of how, you know, the Aboriginals say they come from Pleiades and the star systems. There is something about that. Words really can't describe it. That's how special it is.
Right. I think it does. It does help you go back to the basics where you realize, our ancestors have been having a great time on this planet for centuries without all this technology. And it takes you back to basics, which I think is an important place to be when you approach whatever you're going to do about what's happening. Because it, you know, to a certain extent, we have unleashed, as you said, a tsunami. It's out of control. And to me, the way to surf it is as an entrepreneur. It's going to be very difficult to go fast if you're part of a big institution. And that's why, in some respects, you know, I want to just touch on this before we close. You know, we're in an environment here in the United States, Jason, where the government, between regulation and sort of their manipulation of cost of capital, is very hostile to entrepreneurship. Now, you know, there's certain states that are friendlier than others, so it's spotty, but it has become, the handicaps that an entrepreneur carry vis-a-vis a big corporation are extraordinary. And I think, you know, one of the things that's going to have to happen to make this change really happen is we got to find a way to let government, you know, let up. Now, if we can, we're just going to have to root around them. And the tsunami is big enough and fast enough that I think it may happen. Government won't be able to keep up with it. But I didn't know if you wanted to mention anything about sort of how we deal with a government that's trying to stop change.
Oh, the only thing I can think of is to ignore them without breaking the law. They can't catch us. They really can't. They're so slow. you see what Uber's done to the world, and everyone's raising the flag, get rid of Uber, go home Uber. But it's too late. They're already entrenched. So the best thing we can do as entrepreneurs is see how we can Aikido, how we can take advantage and leverage some of that technology. And there was lots of other things I could have mentioned about, like the Alibaba arbitrage, where you can buy a product, get it manufactured and sell it on eBay or on Amazon and make some margins there, repackage it, build your own brand. There's lots of ways to start thinking about leveraging the technology that's moving, that we can find our little niche and try and get several streams of income. So if one gets shut off by the government, you have access to others. You know, most millionaires will tell you that they have at least seven or more streams of income. So diversify, you know, build your resiliency, and just ignore the government. Just continue on.
Okay, now tell us, how do we just describe your website and how we get the book? Now, am I right? It's publishing today on February 11th.
It is. The easiest way is to go to my website, which is my name, Jason Borden Smith, JasonBordenSmith.com. And you'll see a link directly on the homepage, or if you press book, then you can buy it from Amazon or the publisher, international sales versus Australia sites. It's probably the easiest one, but it should be available on Amazon and most retail outlets. Making Waves, How I Fought Off Sharks to Swim with Dolphins.
Okay, so what's next for Jason? I know you're stirring a lot of pots right now. Are there any you can talk about?
There's two I'd like to just briefly mention. If you want to be very wealthy in the environment that we are now, you have to build a platform. Whether that platform be Facebook, Uber, you need to have a platform where other people can access and you can leverage from. So I have a mutual friend that Catherine and I know who's invited me to help him build an online educational platform. I won't mention its name, but it's very exciting. I won't go into details here, but we're looking at building that platform for online education, which I think is going to be revolutionary, actually. The other project I'm working on is a complaint I've had for 20 years, maybe longer. My mother was hypersensitive to chemicals and also to EMF, electromagnetic fields. And I've known for a long time the electromagnetic effect on humans being real. It is a real biological effect. It is not psychosomatic that the government and the health departments want to tell you that it is. So I haven't been able to talk about it or get involved with it because building a Faraday cage or putting on EMF clothing and the current mitigation processes are just too cumbersome for the average person. However, I am working with an amazing scientist, engineer out of New Zealand. I won't mention his name nor the product, but it's looking very promising. It's only anecdotal. It's only case study driven. We need some more science, but it looks like we found a way to you don't block the EMFs. It just allows you to swim in natural fields that your body will automatically absorb and ignore the artificial. So I don't want to go any more detail than that, but it's very exciting, all of which I'll let you know, Catherine, and you can let your members know.
Some announcements. All of my subscribers are looking for ways of protecting themselves from EMF. It's a major, major concern. So, and report about it. But, you know, finding real practical solutions is tough.
It is, and I think we've nailed it. I don't want to put my reputation or put my, my brand behind it just yet. But I think in a month or so, I'll be in a position to make some formal announcements, and I'm probably going to resurrect my old technology company and help the inventor take it to the world, because it's an issue that I really want to provide a solution to. It is that stone in my shoe that I need to get rid of. So, that's exciting.
Okay. Well, hopefully I'm going to see you down in Australia in May. So until then, Jason, keep us posted on everything you're doing. I can't thank you enough for joining me on the Soleri Report. And I would like to mention also, I wrote the foreword to Making Waves. The book is terrific. So is the foreword.
Thank you so much, Catherine, for everything you do, the forward. And the number one thing you taught me was I'm a patsy. And once I was empowered with that knowledge, then I could take some action to learn what's going on. So thank you so much.
Okay, well, that's my complaint was the call to action to start Soleri is to build everybody's immune system so they don't get rolled or harvested. Well, Jason, have a great day. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.